This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Not too long ago, a group of major employers in the U.S. got together to provide their employees with a path to complete an important part of their education. And we're not talking about technical education or master's degrees.
This is really the first time that a group of national employers have sort of banded together and said, let's really focus on getting our employees who don't have a high school diploma a GED credential.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about GED Works and how this program can help employees finally get their GED. We'll also hear the story of a musician from New Orleans who found a great teacher and a new path in life, learn that our personal genome might not be all that private after all, and we'll spend an academic minute finding out if our genes can make us lonely. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Several years ago, four of the largest employers in the U.S. partnered with GED Testing Service. That's the company that creates and administers the GED exam to create a new program called GED Works. It's a comprehensive benefit program free for employees who want to earn their high school equivalency certificate. The GED Works program includes everything an employee needs to successfully prepare for and pass the GED test. C.T. Turner is Senior Director of Public Affairs for GED Testing Service. We spoke about the program and the companies that helped get it started.
The employers actually approached us, and they were very interested in doing something like this. A couple of the employers that approached us first off had said that they had done some similar things or that they had really done a lot of work in terms of providing scholarships to their employees for post-secondary. But this is really the first time that a group of national employers have sort of banded together and said, let's provide this service. Let's really focus on getting our employees who don't have a high school diploma a GED credential.
It's interesting you talk because we have heard about employers who will pay for college, but this does seem to be the first time that someone will go and help out with a GED.
Absolutely. I think there have been employers in pockets across different locations or in different states that may help a little bit in terms of the fees for the test or reimbursement or something along the lines. But this program's pretty different because it really is all-inclusive. And the employers were very specific about that from the beginning. They wanted something that wasn't just going to be a reimbursement or to help with testing fees or anything along these lines. And so it's pretty different in that a student signs up, they have an orientation, they get a skills assessment, they're then connected with an online study tool, or they're connected with an in-person adult education center. They have a GED advisor, which is really important, because that's a person who's checking in with them at least once a week, encouraging them, motivating them, and sort of coaching them along. Then they have access to free GED-ready practice tests, and then they also have access to the actual GED test.
And what companies, give us an example of the companies that are using this.
Sure. So it's Walmart, KFC, Taco Bell, and Southeastern Grocers, which has Bilo, Winn-Dixie, and Harvey supermarkets.
Is this in any one particular part or region of the country, or is it just nationwide?
It's nationwide. All these employers have made it eligible to any of their employees and their stores who meet the eligibility requirements.
How are the employers using this? Is this an incentive to get better workers?
I think it's a great incentive for, you know, two things for the employers. One is I think it helps them recruit employees, tell them that they have access to this type of program, and it's a way for them to, you know, many of them have put their dreams on hold, and this is a way to find an employer who's supportive of them actually studying, going back, and earning that credential that could really change their life and help them achieve that dream. And then I also think it's a good benefit for current employees, also for retention.
And how has the reaction been? How many people have signed up so far?
So this is just getting rolling. We have a few thousand people in the pipeline already. And I think there are, you know, immediately there are at least tens of thousands of adult learners across the country who are employees of these companies that now have access to this benefit.
And on average, how long does it take someone to go from starting this? And again, it's a new program, but starting this to actually getting the GED?
Yeah, that's a great question. It really does vary, unfortunately. It depends on what you come into it with, maybe when your last year of formal schooling was, what your reading level is, what your comfort level is with some of the different skills. You know, some people could put their mind to it, and maybe they've, you know, I talked with someone from, she finished 11th grade, and she is going to sail through the program. It's probably going to take her a couple months. Someone who comes in at a lower reading level, maybe they only finished, you know, eighth grade or something along those lines, it's going to take them a little bit more time. And the amount of time really depends on the time that they spend to pursuing it, dedication to study, and applying themselves.
Are you seeing all ages getting involved in this?
We are, absolutely. One of the test takers, or someone that's involved in the program who signed up, I did an orientation with her, and she's about 8 years out of school, so that's probably about our average GED test taker age, which is in that, you know, 26 range or so. And she had finished 11th grade, was dual enrolled, wants to become a computer engineer. You know, life got in the way. Her mother was diagnosed with cancer. She had to drop out to take care of her mom and to work. And so this was an opportunity now for her to actually go back and achieve that dream. And she has the support of her employee. She has a financial investment in this. And, you know, she's going to do great things.
It's interesting that these are employers who will hire people who do not have a high school education. They're kind of maybe getting employees that'll get, you know, better trained and move on to better things.
I think that's really an interesting point. I think there's a misperception out there. I know that that was out there when I first started working on this issue about 8 years ago, is a lot of people assume that you can't get a job in the U.S. without a high school diploma or a GED. But in fact, a large number of these employers have a good portion of their workforce that actually don't have a high school diploma or GED. And so I think that, again, talks to why this program is so vitally important. I think why employers are interested is because it really is a good, it's a perk, but it's a great investment for these employers to make and really invest in the lives of their learners. And, you know, some of those employees are going to rise through the ranks and they're going to do great things in those companies. And some of those employees are going to go to other career paths. Some of them might go into college training programs and, you know, change the world.
C.T. Turner is Senior Director of Public Affairs for GED Testing Service. You can get started at GEDWorks.com. Emily McWilliams comes from a family of musicians. She's always performed and written music. She's been playing the piano for 20 years and composes songs for her partner's New Orleans metal band, Thou. Piano tuning was never high on her list of professional aspirations, but with the help of a good teacher, she's come to realize it can be as challenging and precise a process as playing the songs themselves. Nina Feldman has more.
Growing up in New Orleans, Emily McWilliams always thought she'd be a piano player.
I've played the piano since I was 7 years old, so for a little over 20 years now. Growing up, I was always just playing alone, playing in my room, playing for my piano teacher, playing for my recital. I always thought that I would maybe do something with my more artistic sides, writing or writing music, composing.
As she grew older, Emily realized that might not be sustainable. She'd always worked office jobs to make ends meet, but the prospect of having to abandon the world of music for a life of routine administrative work sounded grim. So she did the one thing she thought she never would.
I think it was one of those things, you know, I'm not going to do what my parents did. You know, for a very long time, I thought, there's no way I'm going to do this.
The way you start with one note, which is the A above middle C, and when it's in tune, it's at A440, which means it vibrates at 440 vibrations a second. That's concert pitch.
This is Emily's dad, Matthew McWilliams. Originally a trumpet player, he's been tuning pianos in New Orleans since 1976, and he's taught Emily everything she knows.
Normally, and do correct me if I'm wrong on any of this, Dad, you tune A4. So you would set that to a tuning fork, and then you would tune what is referred to as the temperament, which is...
The whole piano is built around a good, solid temperament.
Basically a two-octave range close to A440.
Then you can expand out to the treble section or to the bass section, whichever direction you want to go.
This is a G, so I just muted off the right string.
How do you know when you've gotten it in tune? It's all because of this listening to beats. If I'm listening to beats, I'm measuring one pitch against another pitch, trying to find an exact spot where that interval is calm. And there's only one spot where it's at its calmest.
If you hear two that are, they should be the same, it'll get, I mean, you can kind of hear that wave there, you know?
I can hear the beats. I couldn't right away.
To get it in tune, you kind of
I had to kind of approach it much more technically, I guess, than like a musical ear. It's a different kind of listening.
Because of the actual physical control of the hammer, he knows exactly when to stop moving it, and I haven't quite gotten there yet.
Emily's been training under her dad for the past 3 years, but she's not taking any paying clients yet. To pass the test required by the Piano Technicians Guild to become a registered piano tuner, you have to be able to tune a piano in under 2 hours. Right now, she's logging in at about 4. Matthew, though, is a pro.
How many pianos do you tune a day right now?
I average 4. That's a comfortable day. But there's days where I'll do 5 or 6. And I've done as many, I think the most I've ever done was 12. That's torture.
This is a guy who makes a lot of house calls.
No, I was in this house where the man is elderly. He has an amazing piano. It's a 9-foot concert grand. And he's very particular, but he's become ill, where he's pretty much bedridden. So he has a helper at his house. And the helper, I think, is there just to help him. But the rest of the house has become a total wreck. I mean, there's music all over the place. You can't hardly turn around. And the whole time I'm tuning this, I'm wondering, why does he want the piano tune? Because he can't get up and play it himself. So I'm not sure. It's one of two things. Either he has somebody else that comes there and plays, or more than likely, he just wanted to hear the piano being tuned. I think that that's probably the case. And he's a composer. You know, he's written a lot of choral music through the years. So I'm just suspecting that he may have wanted company.
For Matthew, piano tuner is a title that just feels natural. And apparently he's not the only one who thinks so.
It was the first Super Bowl after 9/11. There was a piano that was at the convention center. And I was told to be there at a certain time, go to such and such doors. And I thought the credentials getting in the convention center then were almost impossible. I didn't have a pass. I didn't have anything. I thought, you watch, I'm going to go here to tune this piano. And they'll look at me and laugh and tell me to go the other way because they wouldn't let anybody in then after 9/11. So I'm walking up to the door. Here comes a man walking out, and he opens the door. He says, you must be the piano tuner. And I'm thinking, why am I the piano tuner? So I don't know what stereotype that is, but I must look like the piano tuner.
For Emily, though, it's not quite so simple.
Women piano tuners, as far as I know, particularly in New Orleans, there aren't a lot. That's probably pretty normal, at least in the United States. I think that's awesome and an opportunity for me to get into a profession that is mostly male-dominated.
She'll get her chance soon enough.
My dad's business is so huge that he has to reference other piano tuners in the city because he can't fit them in his schedule half the time. So it's convenient. I think it's going to actually be perfect, yeah. Particularly pianists, I think they know how they want their instrument to sound. And it varies from person to person. You know, some people might want a warmer sound. Some people might want a brighter sound. Some people might want the treble stronger than it might be. So that's where a good seasoned tuner like my dad can really tweak each string, each note, and deal with each piano as it is.
She'll get that, but that takes time.
This piece was produced by Nina Feldman as part of the 24-hour radio race from KCRW's Independent Producer Project.
Still to come, science has made it easier than ever to map your own genome. But who has access to that information? That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. In the past decade, a lot of people have taken advantage of new technology and had their entire genome sequenced. Over the next decade, the number of individuals doing this will go from the thousands to the millions. These people are having their genomes sequenced for research, recreational interest, and clinical testing. In the July 2015 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry, there was an article called Intersection of DNA Privacy and Whole Genome Sequencing. It examined the possibility of using existing DNA profile databases to search for and identify individuals who've had their genomes sequenced. One of the authors of that article is Dr. Jason Park, director of the Advanced Diagnostics Laboratory at the Children's Medical Center, Dallas, and assistant professor at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in the Department of Pathology and the Eugene McDermott Center for Human Growth and Development. I spoke to Dr. Park and asked first, just what is whole genome sequencing?
The genome is the DNA material which contains the instructions or blueprints for every organism. Whole genome sequencing is the technology by which an individual's genome can be sequenced or decoded down to the level of individual DNA bases.
Do we know how many humans have had their whole genomes sequenced?
Beginning with the completion of the Human Genome Project, there were initially two individuals whose genomes were sequenced. A decade later, in 2014, there were approximately 230,000 human genomes sequenced. It is now possible for a single laboratory to sequence tens of thousands of human genomes each year.
Your article describes the possibility of identifying specific individuals using genome sequencing. Why is this something we should be worried about?
In 2012, the United States Presidential Commission for the Study of Bioethical Issues issued a report titled Privacy and Progress in Whole Genome Sequencing. The Commission made recommendations to improve privacy and security in the context of genomics. Whole genome sequencing reveals the entire genetic makeup of an individual. Not only does this genetic data inform us on our current disease status, but it also informs us on our future risk of disease. Furthermore, genomic information is a unique identifier of individuals. There are legitimate privacy concerns because genomic information can be used to identify individuals as well as inform us of an individual's current and future risk of disease.
So how did the Presidential Commission address privacy concerns?
The Commission acknowledged that genomics is a rapidly progressing field and that policies that were made would need to be adaptable to changes in technology. The recommendations in 2012 included provisions for protection of research subjects, as well as an outline for coordinated privacy protection at the state and federal level.
Okay, let's go to your study. How did your study examine the use of genomic data to identify individuals?
My collaborators and I speculated that whole genome sequencing data contains the same DNA identifiers that are used in criminal investigations. We realized that if genome datasets contain these specific DNA identifiers, then existing databases of these DNA identifiers could be used to identify individuals based on their genome data.
Can you tell us more about the DNA identifiers used in criminal investigations? What are the databases that currently exist?
The DNA identifiers that I'm referring to are known as STR, or short tandem repeat, profiles. STR loci vary quite a bit from individuals, and if multiple STR loci are tested, we can get a DNA profile that is unique for an individual. 13 specific STR loci are used by the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation in their combined DNA index system, abbreviated CODIS. The CODIS database contains the STR profiles from more than 11 million individuals.
Okay, well, let's get into it. What were you able to find in your study?
Well, luckily for us, another research group had already created a software tool to examine STR loci across large genome datasets. We reanalyzed this group's published data, and we found that on average, 5 of 13 CODIS STR loci were identified in each genome. One genome had all 13 CODIS STR loci identified. The data for matching a genome's STR profile to an individual may be possible. However, the majority of the genome datasets in this public database only yielded partial STR profiles.
So what are the implications of your article?
A basic principle in genomic research has been that while the data is unique for each individual, the data in itself cannot be used to identify an individual. In other words, although my genome information is unique to me, if I gave you that information on a disk, you could not identify me. You would need a decoder ring. in other words, a database to match me to my genomic information. What my collaborators and I are attempting to illustrate is that the existing STR databases, such as FBI CODIS, can be the decoder ring. Given the recent revelations on the United States National Security Agency secret data collection program on internet users, we should anticipate that publicly available whole genome sequencing data may be similarly examined and queried by law enforcement or government agencies.
Well, finally, Dr. Park, what recommendations do you have for research and clinical laboratories doing genomic sequencing?
Research and clinical programs need to rethink how they allow access and share whole genome datasets. CODIS STR profiles can be derived from whole genome datasets. These genome-derived STR profiles can be used to not only identify the research study participants, but also may be used to identify biological relatives. Although access to STR databases such as CODIS is restricted, there may be scenarios where a law enforcement agency could justify searching publicly available genome datasets to identify a person of interest. Entities that have access to DNA STR profile databases have the ability to identify individuals and their biological relatives based on their genomic data. With each technical improvement in sequencing and information technology, there is an increasing probability of re-identification of individuals. In order to protect the DNA privacy of individuals participating in whole genome sequencing, there needs to be constant vigilance to identify and protect against the possible misuse of information.
Dr. Jason Park is, among many other things, director of the Advanced Diagnostics Laboratory at the Children's Medical Center in Dallas. His article about whole genome sequencing and privacy appears in the July 2015 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry. So while we're on the topic, can your genome explain why you feel lonely? Well, that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Loneliness might be passed on from one generation to another. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Abraham Palmer, professor of psychiatry at the University of California, San Diego, examines whether a tendency for loneliness can be found in your genes.
Loneliness is an unpleasant feeling that we're all familiar with. But loneliness isn't just a bad feeling, it's also associated with serious health problems. People with similar networks of friends and family may have very different perceptions of how lonely they are. Twin studies have shown that some of these differences are due to genetic differences. We conducted the first genome-wide association study of loneliness to try to identify its genetic basis. Importantly, we defined loneliness as a lifelong trait rather than a temporary state. We examined genetic and health information for more than 10,000 older adults. Participants answered questions like, how often do you feel left out? Millions of genetic differences were also measured in each person. We then used a statistical technique that evaluated the effects of these genetic differences while also accounting for other important factors, including age, sex, and marital status. Our results showed that the genetic differences we measured captured about 17 to 24% of the variation in how people responded to these questions. We also determined that loneliness was influenced by the same genetic differences that influence personality traits such as neuroticism. Weaker evidence suggested that these same genes also influence the risk for major psychiatric diseases, including schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and major depressive disorder. We are now increasing our sample size in hopes of identifying specific genes that influence loneliness, which could provide fundamental insight into the underlying biological and molecular mechanisms. Our long-term goal is to understand the biological basis of human social behavior.
That was Abraham Palmer of the University of California, San Diego. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.